My name is Jamie. I am an alcoholic. Hi, welcome to the 59th Annual District 22 Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous with Al-Anon participation. All right, before I turn the meeting over to our Al-Anon chair, I have a few convention safety and housekeeping announcements. So first and foremost, let's take a moment to locate the exit nearest you. There are three exits from the main hall, out that way, over here, and then we have another exit through the Al-Anon room in the back. Also, right in this moment, please turn off or silence your cell phone. Because I always think that I did it, but I actually didn't. So maybe double check, lock into that OCD thinking. So the first few rows are reserved for our speakers and people who are having a hard time hearing. If at any point you cannot hear the speaker, please come up and sit in any open seat in the first three rows. We want to make sure you can hear what's going on. Please remember that San Luis Obispo has a no smoking ordinance. There is no smoking in the building or in front of the building. If you smoke, please use the designated area in the parking lot behind us and dispose of cigarette butts in the butt can. Thank you for your cooperation. And it does cost a lot of money to put on this convention, so we depend on your registration. If you have not yet registered, don't worry. Up front, you can go to the registration table and they'll get you all signed up. First aid information is over there at hospitality with Kathleen. If you need emergency care, go over there. There is no food or open containers in the main hall, so just enjoy them outside, but not in this space right here. Please use the designated recycling and trash containers. Additionally, parents, be responsible for your children just so that everybody can hear what's going on. As a courtesy to the speakers and listeners, please keep all of our volume throughout the hall to a minimum. Also, we do have marathon meetings every hour on the hour, and so many people have signed up for that. We have a few spots left. If anyone's interested, you just go to myd22.org, hit the menu, and you can sign up. Most of them are, unfortunately, in the wee hours, but that's okay. We can do it. Please check your convention program for scheduled events, locations, and any additional information throughout the weekend. Thank you. It is my pleasure to introduce Margaret G., who will lead our Al-Anon family speaker meeting. Margaret.
Hi, everybody. My name is Margaret, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I am serving as the speaker chair this year and the leader of this meeting. Welcome to the 2026 District 22 AA Convention with Al-Anon participation. Our theme this year is a new freedom and a new happiness. The complete schedule of all events can be found on the District 22 Convention website at myd22.org. First, I would like to thank and recognize Jamie T., the AA committee chairperson, and the entire AA convention committee for the invitation to participate and collaborate in this year's convention. That was just Jamie right there. Please join us for our Al-Anon theme meetings that are located in the Al-Anon room over here. A list of times, themes, and leaders are posted, and all are welcome. We invite you to join us in the main hall at 7:30 p.m. for the opening welcome by Jamie T., again, our convention chairperson, followed by the golf chair, Andrew Y., for the golf awards. Then at 8 p.m., our AA welcome speaker is Kenna F. from Pasadena, California. Finally, we are excited to have you join in the fun for salsa lessons and dancing beginning at 9:30 p.m. tonight, led by our Al-Anon chairperson, Sabrina. Can't wait. We welcome you all. We welcome all District 3 Al-Anon members, our AA families and friends, and all of our visitors from across the U.S. This is our family speaker meeting, and we are looking forward to hearing Guy and Debbie S. share with us today. After a moment of silence, please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. This is our Al-Anon welcome. We welcome you to this Al-Anon family group meeting and hope you will find in this fellowship the help and friendship we have been privileged to enjoy. We who live or have lived with the problem of alcoholism understand as perhaps few others can. We too were lonely and frustrated, but in Al-Anon we discover that no situation is really hopeless and that it is possible for us to find contentment and even happiness whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. We urge you to try our program. It has helped many of us find solutions that lead to serenity. So much depends on our own attitudes, and as we learn to place our problem in its true perspective, we find it loses its power to dominate our thoughts and our lives. The family situation is bound to improve as we apply the Al-Anon ideas. Without such spiritual help, living with an alcoholic is too much for most of us. Our thinking becomes distorted by trying to force solutions, and we become irritable and unreasonable without knowing it. The Al-Anon program is based on the suggested 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which we try, little by little, one day at a time, to apply to our lives, along with our slogans and the Serenity Prayer. The loving interchange of help among members and daily reading of Al-Anon literature thus makes us ready to receive this priceless gift of serenity. Al-Anon is an anonymous fellowship. Everything that is said here in the group meeting and member to member must be held in confidence. Only in this way can we feel free to say what is on our minds and in our hearts, for this is how we help one another in Al-Anon. The Al-Anon family groups are a fellowship of relatives and friends of alcoholics. This is our Al-Anon preamble. The Al-Anon family groups are a fellowship of relatives and friends of alcoholics who share their experience, strength, and hope in order to solve their common problems. We believe alcoholism is a family disease and that changed attitudes can aid recovery. Al-Anon is not allied with any sect, denomination, political entity, organization, or institution. Does not engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. There are no dues for membership. Al-Anon is self-supporting through its own voluntary contributions. Al-Anon has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps ourselves, by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics, and by giving understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic. And I have asked Eileen G. to read the 12 steps for us today.
Hi, I'm Eileen. The 12 steps, because of their proven, because of their proven power and worth, Al-Anon's, I gotta get my glasses, I'm sorry. I'm not prepared. That's sad. Sorry, guys, I'm sorry. All right, yeah, better. I can see the words. Okay, because of their proven power and worth, AA's 12 steps have been adopted almost word for word by Al-Anon. They represent a way of life appealing to all people of goodwill of any religious faith or none. Note the very power of the words. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and searching moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Ten, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Eileen. And I have asked Michael D. to read the 12 traditions.
Hey guys, my name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. The traditions that follow bind us together in unity. They guide the groups in their relations with other groups, with AA and the outside world. They recommend group attitudes toward leadership, membership, money, property, public relations, and anonymity. The traditions evolved from the experience of AA groups in trying to solve their problems of living and working together. Al-Anon adopted these group guidelines and has found them sound and wise. Although they are only suggestions, Al-Anon's unity and perhaps even its survival are dependent on adherence to these principles. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal progress for the greater number depends upon unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The relatives of alcoholics, when gathered together for mutual aid, may call themselves an Al-Anon family group, provided that, as a group, they have no other affiliation. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting another group or Al-Anon or AA as a whole. 5. Each Al-Anon family group has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves, by encouraging and understanding our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics. 6. Our family groups ought never endorse, finance, or lend our name to any outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary spiritual aim. Although a separate entity, we should always cooperate with Alcoholics Anonymous. 7. Every group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Al-Anon 12-step work should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. Our groups, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. The Al-Anon family groups have no opinion on outside issues, hence our name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films, and TV. We need guard with special care the anonymity of all AA members. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles above personalities.
And I have asked Brenda Kay to read Understanding Ourselves.
Right. Good evening, everyone. I'm Brenda, and I'm an alcoholic and Al-Anon. Understanding Ourselves. Family and friends are affected. Alcoholism is a family disease. Compulsive drinking affects the drinker and affects the drinker's relationships, friendships, employment, childhood, parenthood, love affairs, and marriages all suffer from the effects of alcoholism. Those special relationships in which a person is really close to an alcoholic are affected most, and the people who care are the most caught up in the behavior of another person. We react to an alcoholic's behavior. Seeing that the drinking is out of hand, we try to control it. We are ashamed of the public scenes, but we try to handle it in a private. It isn't long before we feel we are to blame and take on the hurts, the fear, the guilt of an alcoholic. We too can become ill. Even well-meaning people begin to count the number of drinks another person is having. We may pour expensive liquor down the drains, search the house for hidden bottles, or listen to the sound of opening cans. All our thinking becomes directed at what the alcoholic is doing or not doing, and how to get the drinker to stop drinking. This is our obsession. Watching fellow human beings slowly kill themselves with an alcohol is painful. While alcoholics don't seem to worry about the bills, the job, the children or the condition of their health, the people around them usually begin to worry. We often make the mistake of covering up. We try to fix everything, make excuses for their lies, mend damaged relationships, and worry some more. This is our anxiety. Sooner or later, the alcoholic behavior makes other people angry. We realize the alcoholic is telling lies, using us, not taking care of responsibilities, and we may begin to feel that the alcoholic doesn't love us. We want to strike back, punish, make the alcoholic pay for the hurt and the frustration caused by uncontrolled drinking. This is our anger. Sometimes those people who are close to the alcoholic begin to pretend. We accept promises and trust the alcoholic. Each time there is a sober period, however brief, we want to believe the problem has gone away forever. When good sense tells us there is something wrong with this alcoholic's drinking and thinking, we still hide how we feel and what we know. This is our denial. Perhaps the most severe damage to those of us who have shared some part of the life with the alcoholic comes in the form of nagging belief that we are somehow at fault. We may feel it's something we did or did not do, that we are not good enough, not attractive enough, or not clever enough to have solved the problem for the one we love. These are our feelings of guilt.
And finally, I have asked Erlene S. to read Help and Hope.
Help and Hope. We have turned to Al-Anon, not to alcohol, but to Al-Anon. We have turned to Al-Anon and have often done so in despair, unable to believe in the possibility of change and unable to go on as we have before. We feel cheated out of a loving companion, overburdened with responsibilities, unwanted, unloved, and alone. There are even those of us who are arrogant, smug, self-righteous, and dominating. I don't recognize that person. Anyway, we come to Al-Anon, however, because we want and need help. While we have been driven to Al-Anon, to Al-Anon, by the effects of someone else's drinking, we soon come to know that our own thinking has to change before we can make a new and successful approach to living. It is in Al-Anon that we learn to deal with our obsession, our anxiety, our anger, our denial, and our feelings of guilt. It is through the fellowship that we ease our emotional burdens by sharing our experience, strength, and hope with others. Little by little, we come to realize at our meetings that much of our discomfort comes from our attitudes. I know it's surprising. We begin to change these attitudes and learn about our responsibilities to ourselves. We discover feelings of self-worth, love, and we grow spiritually. The emphasis begins to be lifted from the alcoholic and placed where we do have some power over our own lives.
All right, I would like to thank all of you very much for reading. At this time, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our family speakers, Guy and Debbie S. Guy is going to go first, and then Debbie gets the rebuttal. They're both from Pismo Beach, to share their experience, strength, and hope. So welcome, Guy, up to the stage.
Hi. Hello, my name's Guy S., and I'm an alcoholic and a grateful member of Al-Anon. And, well, you know, I just want to take a second and thank the committee that puts this show on, because there's dozens of folks that do this, and they start, I think, in October, and they work diligently throughout the year, every year, and they do a great job. This room's been a great room for us, and there's lots of good recovery, lots of good energy, lots of fun, lots of fellowship, lots of dedication. So I've not seen the tags, but usually they have a tag on saying they're a committee member. If you see any of those folks, certainly give them our appreciation and love up on them. And I appreciate them very much, and why don't we just take a second and give them a hand. And I don't talk that often, well, from a podium. And I will steal a line from my sponsor. Anytime I'm at a podium and I don't have to enter a plea, that's a good thing. So, and that what I'm trying to say is I'll probably get lost, so forgive me for that. And then when you hear it, I'll be just as surprised as what I say as when I hear it. So anyway, born in beautiful Flint, Michigan. Yeah, probably one of the crappiest cities in the country. And if you don't believe so, read Google. You know, my dad, when I was born, was in Jackson State Prison. He was also an alcoholic, untreated alcoholic his entire life. I didn't meet him till I was 10 years old. And he got put in prison for killing a family of four one night. And he was in Jackson State Prison for probably not long enough, to tell you the truth. And it was a terrible embarrassment to his family. I don't know if I'll get to that point in my story in the 20 minutes that I got here. But my mom ended up marrying his name was Lawrence. My mom named me after him. And I was born in my great-grandmother's garage there in Flint. And so she wouldn't call me by his name, so I grew up with the name of Skip. And so anyway, then my mom married another guy because it was cold. If you didn't know, Michigan's cold, and the garages are not that warm in Michigan. And so she ended up sidling in with this guy, Jimmy Joe James, out of southern Missouri. And Ozarks, from the Ozarks. And he was a Marine Corps sniper, Special Forces, and he was angry, and he was cruel. And so we had a very violent household as a child, and I'd see my mom get her nose busted. And we ate he was a hunter. And I don't know if he's connected or what, but he had a few businesses there in Flint. He had some businesses in downtown Flint where white people don't own businesses. And he was always safe and extremely violent guy. We lived in a little suburban neighborhood. And so we'd have carcasses hanging off of the carport, duck blinds in the front yard, and strange family. We were strange and not a intermixing family. And so, you know, like my mom would get beat up on a regular basis. I was a bedwetter. And that did not continue into my alcoholic days. Debbie's thankful for that. And till I was about, anyway, every morning I had to get up and go and have my pajamas checked. And every morning they were wet. And so every morning I got beat. And not like a spanking. Like, I got beatings. And, you know, bruising up and down my back and down the back of my legs. And if you've ever, you know, lived in that kind of a situation, you realize that that physical pain actually is very easy to shut off. It's kind of surprising. And so I just, and the reason I'm not saying that to gain sympathy, because the reality is lots of people had a lot harder than I had it, by far. And but what I did was I retreated into myself, spent lots of time by myself in the bedroom, and then what also was accompanied with that is emotional humiliation. So then I'd have to wear my wet underwear on my head as a young boy. And if there was company over, it was particularly hurtful. And so what I did was I came out of that exceedingly shut down, I'll tell you that. And so then my mom, she ended up fleeing Michigan, and we came out to California. Just before we fled Michigan, my biological father got paroled. I went up and saw him at 10. And by that time, I was drinking. I started drinking when I was 8. My grandma, Frankie, you know, would give me her half-empty Drury's beer, and I would drink that. And I always say I started way too late. But I was using it as as a means of connection with my grandmother, just something. I don't know what it was. But by the time I went up and saw my biological father up in Traverse City in Michigan after he paroled out of Jackson State Prison, it was a trip. I went up there as a 10-year-old boy, and like back then you just put a 10-year-old on the Greyhound bus. And it's 12, 13 hours, and then meeting this guy for a first time was a trip. And so we went straight to the bar. And if you're an alcoholic and you got a 10-year-old kid with you, then my drink at the bar was slow gin and 7-Up. So I drink slow gin and 7-Up all day, maybe some beer chasers, and Larry would drink straight alcohol. So he was not a very trustworthy guy. He played pranks on us and stuff like that. And so when I got back, we moved to Southern California, Tustin, California, as a matter of fact, that's where I got sober. Did I get sober in Tustin? I actually did get sober in Tustin, California. And but we were broke. We were very poor. So we were on food stamps back then. It was probably called food stamps. They're not called that now. And so, you know, powdered milk, instant rice, packets of gravy, that was kind of the diet. And, you know, the reality is I just didn't have any tools. I wasn't participating in school, got out of school early, and the kids I hung out with were very also not upstanding model citizens. I think my best friend, Joe and John Cook, my best friend John, growing up in Michigan, was killed himself in a sanitarium at 13. And Joe ended up selling drugs down in Key West, Florida. So those are the kind of guys that I hung out with. Those are the kind of guys I rolled with. And so when I got to Tustin, that's what I did. I was drinking and I worked. I worked before school. I worked after school. And I made sure that I was keeping myself safe and had a little folding money. So anyway, that went on and on. I got to get around to get sober here. I met Debbie. First time I met Debbie, I was driving a Fiat Spider, rainy. She had a guy that worked for her dad. I was dropping non-alcoholic enticements off to him, and porn ring, top down, drinking tequila out of a brown paper bag. And, you know, that guy, for some reason, tried to get Debbie and I together forever until we got together. And then he tried everything to keep us apart. But it could have been that he was, they were actually ended up being roommates. And she invited me to, like, spend, you know, several nights over there. And maybe, I don't know. But Debbie took an interest in me. Actually, what it was she was doing her teeth down in, Debbie's Canadian, and she was, her orthodontist was down in Tijuana, Mexico, and I spent some time down in Guadalajara, and I knew for a young woman to go down to Tijuana was not that safe. And so I would travel with her to Tijuana while she would get her teeth worked on by her dentist, Coco, from Tijuana. Yeah, I felt the same way. What's up with this? And well, our relationship just kind of like grew from there. And really, it's like I never let anybody in. I'm completely safe. It's still something that I have to struggle with, be completely safe just being on my own, because it's the first thing we learned here, right? Can't do it on your own. And ended up going to a little hospital in Tustin, California, and 30-day hospital. My roommate in the hospital was DEA on Santa Ana Police Department, and he would, when we were in there, they were doing a expose on the busting tar houses. That's heroin, tar house, and Mexican tar houses in Santa Ana. And he would always volunteer to be the entry team. He was a non-vet, and spent, after he did his tours and duty, he went back as a field medic. And so he was John C. He was a tough guy, a smart guy, and definitely not the kind of guys I would hang out with. And he was not the kind, or I was not the kind of guy he hung out with. But that's what happens here in AA. And Al-Anon, I presume. People that are not alike end up mixing, and we hold each other's hands, and we find a new way of life. So that's where Al-Anon came in, and that's where my AA program started. And then I got lucky enough, well, I didn't get sober. I got sober out of that one, but after 11 months, that my sobriety date right now, 11/21/1987. And touch wood, that's going to be it for the rest of my life. And so that was in January when I went into that hospital. And they would make exceptions for John and I to, like, go exercise. So Debbie would come, and I'd give her a list of stuff to bring me from the house, right? Could you bring me some running shoes? You know, we're going to go golfing. Could you bring me my golf clubs and my cleats? And she would bring them to me, and then they forced her to go to Al-Anon. And then we ended up getting out. I ended up getting out, and life got a little better, but I wasn't able to stay on course. I didn't do everything that I needed to do, so I went back out in July of that year, right when her dad passed. You know, and a perfect timing for Deb. So just all, once again, everything just completely in our lives collapsed all at the same time. And my last drunk was, we ended up getting a little house in Laguna Niguel. And my last drunk was in that little house after Debbie had moved out. She had finally moved to Northern California. I moved her stuff up there. We moved her stuff up there. She fled the scene of the crime. And my last drunk was on a bunch of moving pads in a house with no furniture. And I've been trying to get sober through church. And it just happened that a preacher and his family moved right across the street from us, and we were part of their church. And And I'd go on these runs. I drank every day, but I'd have to go on these runs. And no eating, just doing things we don't talk about here. And then when I'd come down, I just drank straight booze for a few days. And so it was during the come down period. And that guy was out at one of the sliding glass doors. I was in the master bedroom on all the pads. Guy was out in the sliding glass door, and he had his two young boys there, and they were praying for me. Because they were close to our family, and they watch alcohol and drugs destroy our family. And that was my last drink, actually. And then Dr. Paul Oh was pitching at the 902 meeting in Tustin, California, at the Knights of Columbus on Sunday morning that Thanksgiving. That was a Thanksgiving, another holiday that I spent alone and separated from my family, or my family spent separated from me. And Paul gave his number from the podium. You know, my name's Paul. I'm an alcoholic. My number is 240-3940. I never wrote it down, but I started calling him. And then Paul sent me to Frank. I thought I saw John here, John Mack. He was Frank's priest at his parish, and Frank was a lawyer. And so Frank started dragging me around to meetings. That's where it all began. And that's where I started grabbing traction. Paul told me that I was supposed to call Debbie and tell her if she didn't get involved in Al-Anon and start working a decent program of Al-Anon, I was going to take her back. And I got to tell you, I don't know how many alcoholics are in the room, particularly drug addicts. But there are times when we can throw down ultimatums, and there are times when we can't. And that was definitely one of the times I couldn't. And so, you know, I just did what they told me. I didn't tell Debbie that. But there were lots of things that didn't make sense. What you're going to find out here, the message that I want to give is if you're here because your life is just completely torn up, and there's no way out, you're at that jumping off place where you can't imagine life continuing the way it is, and you can't imagine life without drinking or using, that there is a way out. And it might not make any sense at all, but if you give it a complete try, for the book says a year, but it takes longer than that. That's the bad news. So the next thing Paul told me to do was go to a meeting and talk to somebody with less time than me. So at this point in time, I've got, a week? And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, I'm the person dying here. I'm the person with no furniture living in my car. And, and I'm supposed to talk to somebody with less time. But that ended up, I followed directions. That ended up working out. I had this old Suburban. It had wood in the back and only three doors on it. Two doors on the passenger side. That's the way they used to make them. And that was my RV, my recovery vehicle. And then I'd talk to somebody with less time. I could sell dope on the street. I could sell drugs in dark alleys. But I could not walk up to you and say, hey, hi, you know, have a conversation. So I'd look for somebody as terrified as me in the meeting and say, do you come here all the time? What's up? What meetings do you go to? That sort of a thing. And then we ended up piling in my Suburban and going out to all these meetings in Orange County, down at Majestic Canyon, stuff like that. And men work with men, and women work with women. And so I had all these guys that would pile in, all brand newcomers. And so when we pile into some fireside meeting in Majestic Canyon, we were puppies, Labradors, clamoring out of a whelping pen. And then the long-timers there, they totally loved us. Come on over for dinner after the meeting and just started luffing up on us. And that was completely different for me because I lived a completely different, isolated life, shut down from all my feelings. And so I could go on and on, but this time, my time's out. That's my thing. That's my 20 minutes. And I'd like to end with this one reading that I read. And it's from a member's eye view. And it is the best pamphlet. And it's the perfect way that Alcoholics Anonymous is for me. AA will probably always number among its ranks those who in their fear and in their anger would make AA some sort of a spiritual ghetto, a sort of co-ed monastery where alcoholics hide and lick their wounds, coining childish and defensive words like normsies and alkie, and pointing accusing fingers at the tigers, air quotes, out there. There must come a time, must come a day, it seems to me, when every alcoholic in or out of AA finally sits down in the presence of his enemies. When he does, he'll be amazed to discover that he is attending a meeting of one, himself. The day that the alcoholic in AA realized the enemy is within, that tigers are largely creatures of his own design and lurk in his own unconscious, that is the day when AA, for him, when AA becomes what I believe its founders meant it to be, a flight into reality. I happened to be in San Francisco not long after I attended my meeting with my enemies, and I took a ride on one of those wonderful little cable cars down Powell Street to Fisherman's Wharf. It was then that I saw something strange and wonderful happen. All the passengers who had ridden the car down the hill with me piled out and, not waiting for the crew, proceeded to turn themselves around and head back up that long, steep hill it had just come down. And I rode it all the way back up with them, all the way back up to that breathtaking view of the Golden Gate. It occurred to me then that is what AA has been for me, and hope it would always be for others. A ridiculously simple, jury-built, noisy, clanky, but sturdy, fiercely loved, and joyous kind of a vehicle that had asked me and all of the other passengers to turn it and ourselves around so that all of us could head back up that hill we had come down, back up the hill to where we could once see the bridge to normal living. I love you all. Thank you very much for giving me and my family our life.
Thank you, Guy. That was wonderful. And I would like to invite Debbie up.
Hi, everybody. My name is Debbie Spaulding. I am a grateful member of Al-Anon. I'm the non-drinking member of Team Spaulding. Guy, obviously, he's the alcoholic. We also have two daughters that are sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the only non-drinking member of my family. But it's good to be here. I appreciate the committee inviting us to come and share. I never really quite figure out how I end up here, but I do, and thank you, Margaret, for inviting us. We ran into Margaret in a bakery in Paso Robles, and she said, hey, how would you like to come speak at the convention? I don't know. But to be asked by somebody like Margaret, because I respect her and her program so much, it really is truly an honor to be here. I don't think I remembered it correctly, but... You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has a book, it's called As Bill Sees It. Al-Anon has a book, it's called Lois Remembers. And so, we were stone cold sober through all of this nonsense. But yeah, he's my desperado, for sure. He's a good man, good man. We've been through a lot, and he's a good guy. So I never know where to start any of all of this. You know, in 20 minutes, it's, oh, honey, I didn't start. Oh, well, now it started. I think that Guy and I were kids when we met. I think Guy was like 19 or 20. I was like 21, 22. You know, that was a long, long time ago. And this past July, we celebrated 43 years of marriage. Yeah. Dr. Paul used to say that don't be more impressed by that than I am, because we really shouldn't be together. And in my Al-Anon birthday, the day that I came into Al-Anon was January 15th of 1987. So this past January, it was 39 years in Al-Anon. So, you know, it's been a long, strange trip, you know, for sure. But I got to go to a Paso Robles Tuesday noon meeting this week. If you ever get to Paso Robles on a Tuesday, there's a noon meeting there. It's a great meeting. Hi, Irene. Great meeting. And they have this pamphlet. And I walked in. I always love it when I walk into an Al-Anon meeting and they hand me a newcomer's packet. Because I usually always feel like a newcomer anyway. But they have this, I don't know if you guys have seen this newcomer's packet. I remember when the packet used to be all those little, flyers inside of a packet. And now it's in this just one book. And it's so great. And so I took it Guy took it and then I read it. Of course I did. But in the first section of this, what do you do about the alcoholic's drinking? And then it goes on, and there's like three or four pages of all these things that the Al-Anon person does for an alcoholic. And I was reading these, and I was thinking, if this was a test for me before I came into Al-Anon, I would have passed it 100%. I did everything that's in this pamphlet. I was astounded when I read it. I've been here a long time, and I was just like, oh my God, I did all that stuff. The only thing Guy said to me, I think I've done everything on that in those pages. And he said, well, I don't think you've never, because there's violence was one of the things. He says, well, you've never hit me. And he forgot. Because I did, but most of the time he was passed out. So I don't know, does that still count? I'm not sure. But yeah, I did all of that, you know, and so the disease of alcoholism is such a devastating disease. The disease of alcoholism is the only disease that will kill somebody that doesn't have it. And the disease of alcoholism was killing me in my marriage. It was killing me physically. I was sick. The year before Guy got sober, I was sick. Every 2 weeks, I swear, I was sick all the time with something. It killed my spirit. It killed my trust. It killed my hopes. It killed my dreams. You all know. Like, if you're an Al-Anon and you've been with a drinking alcoholic, you know. You know the deal. You know what it's like. And it was devastating to watch this man dying in front of my eyes. It was 1986, it was in the spring of 1986, and I was in that home in Laguna Niguel where we live. We had a little home there, and I was in the room, and Guy was, there was alcohol in our home every day. Breakfast was beer, lunch was wine, dinner was cocktails, every day. We bought wine and champagne by the case. It was just part of what was happening. The drugs are what really were the real killer, and so what Guy would do is he would just disappear, and he would be gone for like 3 or 4 days. I wouldn't know where he was or what he was doing, if he was alive or dead. And this went on for years. So he would come back, and he would come back home. I would say the whole time he was gone, I said, oh, he comes back, I'm going to kill him. And he would come back home, and I would nurse him back to health because I had a life here that I was trying to support. Guy's 6'4", and for the most of the time, for the 4 or 5 years of his active drinking and using, I was trying to hide him. And he was trying to hide from me. That was kind of the game that we were playing all the time. And so I was in this room in 1986. It was in the spring. I was down on my knees, and he'd been gone for a few days. I didn't know where he was. And I was praying to a God that I didn't really understand. And I was praying that he take Guy away from this life, because that no person should have to suffer the way I watched my husband suffer. And obviously, it was an unanswered prayer, because he's sitting right here, but he, but when I got up off my knees that day, I had this overwhelming feeling that whatever I was dealing with in my home, because I didn't know it had a name, I didn't know it was alcoholism, I didn't know it was really drug addiction, I really wasn't sure, but I knew what whatever I was dealing with in my home was bigger than me. It was bigger than me, it was bigger than Guy. And I think that was, for me, the first time that I really kind of let go. The disease of alcoholism and drug addiction became known to me as the beast, because I could see it in his eyes. I could see the beast in his eyes. When he would use, I would know before he even opened his mouth. I could see it. And so that was in 1986 in the spring. He got continually worse through the end of that year. That Christmas 1986, he didn't show up for Christmas that year. He was gone. I went up to Northern California to be with my family, took the girls up there, and he followed me up there afterwards, and he said, I promise this is it. You know, I'm done. I'm finished. And I promise I'm going to get better. I'm going to get help. We came back to Laguna Niguel, and within a week, he was gone again. And yeah, you know, it's like, you want to believe him, man. You want to believe it. Just never. And the disease of alcoholism just is so huge. And so so he came back home, and it was the first time he was laying on the sofa, and he said to me, he said, Debbie, he said, would you stay up with me all night and just, like, make sure I, because I think I'm dying, but just kind of wake me up every 15, 30 minutes and make sure I'm okay. And you know, I'm a pre-Al-Anon gal. I'm gonna do it. You know, so I sat there on that chair and I watched my husband, who is 6'4", weighed 135 pounds, was ashen gray, with like stuff just leaking out of his eyes. And I sat up that night, and I would wake him up, and we got through it. I got through that night. But the next day, you know, I said, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do it. And that's when he went into the hospital in Tustin. He called around, and it was interesting. I always remember his intake. I don't know if he remembers this, but his intake counselor at that hospital in Tustin said to Guy, do you remember? He said, do you ever see the beast looking back at you in your rearview mirror? And I thought, wow, yeah, the beast. I saw it. I saw it. And Guy saw it. And he stayed. And he was there for 30 days. And as part of his... the family participation in this, you know, 30-day program was for me to go to Al-Anon, and that's when I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. Was out. I didn't know what Al-Anon was. I had not a clue, not one clue what Al-Anon was. I thought that they wanted me to go to Al-Anon so badly in that recovery hospital. I thought that it was the place they sent you to teach you how to keep them sober once they got them sober. And I showed up at my first meeting, and it was big. It's like Southern California, you know, they have 60 people in the room. And it was a big meeting, and I don't know if they read the steps. I don't know if they read traditions. I have no idea what they read. But what I heard in that room that night was something that I had never really heard. Two things. I heard hope, and I heard laughter. And there was no laughter in my home anymore. Everything was deadly, deadly serious. Because my life was falling apart. I had to get this guy on the right track. And it wasn't working out very well for me. It was killing me. So anyway, he didn't get sober. But I'm going to, like, really fast forward. So I got into Al-Anon. I started going to meetings. I got a sponsor. I moved to Northern California. Like he said, I fled. He came up there. And I was going to meetings, and because I think this is an important story to tell, because it's my story. I think it's important because at 5 years in Al-Anon, thought I was doing all the stuff I was supposed to be doing, but I was more unhappy than I'd ever been, ever. And it was that I was at that place where I was trying to fill that hole in me with all of this outside stuff. It was still like important what like Guy was doing and what the girls were doing and what school they were going to and what car we were driving and what kind of work we were doing and the house that we owned. And I was, it was just all of that outside worldly stuff was still there for me. And I was still trying to live this life that I thought that I should be living or wanted to be living. And so I was just miserable. And Guy called Paul, and Paul said, well, here, tell Debbie to call this girl. She lives in Burbank, California. All the best people come from Burbank, California. And where's Julie? There she is. Don't they, Julie? Yeah. And so Maria, her name was Maria S. And I called up Maria, and she's, and her and I connected right away, and she was tough, man. She was tough. It was not, none of this, like, I'll love you until you can love yourself. That was bullshit to her, foreign. She didn't know. And so she said to me, she says, I want you to get a copy of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you to get, not Guy's, I want you to get your own, and I want you to start reading it. And so I did that because I was so miserable. I just would take, I would do what anybody told me at that point. So I got the book and I started reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. When Guy first got sober, I read the book and I would think, oh yeah, that's him. Oh yeah, he does that. Oh yeah, he definitely does that. Oh, he has a problem with that. When I read it at 5 years in Al-Anon, it was scary because what happened was, is that I do that. I think that. I feel that. And I got to the place in the book, it's on page 60, and it's right after the three pertinent ideas, and there's about four or five paragraphs there. If you're brave enough, read them. And I read those pages, and it talks about being the director, you know, directing the play, managing well, you know, it's like making sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing, not playing God anymore. And I read those, and I shut the book, and I called Maria, and I said, Maria, I got bad news. She goes, what's wrong? I think I'm an alcoholic. Dead silence. She goes, really? She says, well, when's the last time you had a drink? I said, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I have no idea. And she goes, another dead silence. She goes, well, more will be revealed. So I kept working the steps with Maria, and I got through that, and I did a fourth and a fifth step with her down in Burbank, and it was revealed to me. See, I don't, when I hear alcoholics talk, I identify with them 100% all the time. I heard a girl talk in Cambria not long ago, and she told a story about something she did drinking that I did sober. Who's crazier? I was sober doing the same thing she was doing. The difference between the alcoholic and me is that I don't have the physical allergy to ethyl alcohol. I don't have the phenomenon of craving, but I have everything else. And that's kind of sometimes a scary place. But I realize that my drink has two legs. That's what I found out. I'm addicted to addicts, pretty much. And so it was good. So I worked through the steps. She encouraged me to get a sponsor in Northern California. And I got a sponsor up there. And my life changed. Maria changed the trajectory of my life. I was like, you know, when I got to that place in the fourth step where I had that fourth column where what's my responsibility, and I would call her up and I go, you know, I don't think I have a responsibility here. And she'd go, that's the most selfish, self-centered thing I've ever heard. And I, wow. And so we worked through that, you know, and what happened is that as a result of working those steps with Maria, I will forever be indebted to her. What had changed for me was that I became an active participant in my own life. I was an active participant. I took responsibility where responsibility was due, and I started to live a good life. You know, we had a good life. And Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon are, for me, the foundation of my life. They're like the foundation. Everything good, everything positive, everything I love, everything has come from that foundation. It has sprung from that. I don't know what I don't know what it would have been like to be without these rooms and without the people in the rooms. It's, they've saved me, man. They've just saved me. And Save me from myself. I was talking, Guy and I were talking about egos the other day, and I said, oh God, I think my ego is just trying to kill me right now. And, you know, and the steps really helped me with that. We've been blessed, Guy and I have been tremendously blessed with sponsorship that is like top shelf. Our sponsors have been so wonderful and so loving, and he had a sponsor in Northern California. His name was Nick McComb. He passed away a few years ago, but I love Nick with all my heart, and he is a really good man. And he told me this thing about the first three steps, and I really love it a lot, and I'll share it with you. He talked about the first step, you know, admitted I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. That's the problem. The problem. Lack of power is my problem. Lack of control over the alcoholic is my problem. If I can identify the problem, I might be on the right road. Two, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. The solution. My solution is always God. Always, always God. That's the solution for me. And the way that I access that solution today is through love. Love and God are the same things to me. Step three, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand God. A commitment to pursue the solution. And how do I pursue the solution? Steps 4 through 12. That's what I do. I work those steps. When life gets rough for me, I work the steps. That's just what I do. That's what I've been taught, and that's what I do. I'm going to share with you a little story. I have just a few more minutes. And I don't ever really talk about our daughters too much. I always thought that they have two daughters. I'll name them, Shannon and Shelby. And I always thought that because they were raised in a non-drinking home in the 12-step recovery programs, that they would be immune from the disease of alcoholism. So it was a big shock to me when that was not the case. And in about 2013... my youngest daughter, Shelby, came to live with me, and she was really in the height of her drinking and using. And my sponsor, who lived in Atascadero, had just passed away, and I didn't have a sponsor, but I knew in my heart if I was going to get through this that I was going to have to get back into the steps again. So I started looking around for a sponsor, and this one woman, her name kept popping into my head. It was a really weird thing. And the only reason it kept popping in my head, because wherever I would go anywhere, we didn't even go to the same meeting. She went to the Cayucas Monday meeting. I went to Thursday, San Luis. But everywhere I see her, she would know my name. She would always say, oh, hey, Debbie, how are you? I thought, wow, how does she remember my name? So when I knew that, I thought, you know, I think that I'm going to call her and ask her if she'd go through the steps with me. And she did. And I love her dearly. Because for the next 2 years, while Shelby was living with us and in the height of her disease, she worked the steps with me in her home every Wednesday night. And I would do it. We'd do the Path to the Recovery book, and I would answer all those questions. And she was there every week. And it just saved me. And to the point where, you know, at one point I got the courage to actually ask Shelby to leave our home. And I had to ask her to leave our home, and she had nowhere to go. I was really putting her out on the street, you know. And she lived, she's couch surfed, and she lived in her car for a while, and she made a strange trip to Las Vegas. I don't know what the hell happens in Las Vegas, but I don't think it's good. And, you know, Eileen walked me through that. I'm sorry. I just broke your knee. I'm sorry. Anyway, she walked me through that. You know, that's where I got the courage. That's it. You know, I worked the steps with her, and I'm 0 for 0 on getting somebody sober. I don't know about y'all, the rest of you, but like I've had no success at all in getting people sober. And, but the people of Alcoholics Anonymous seem to have the secret, you know? And so I really want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous, number one, for so generously giving Al-Anon the 12 steps, so that I too can recover from the devastating effects of alcoholism. And I also want to thank Alcoholics, the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, for the sobriety in my home. Because without you, I don't think they'd be sober. I really don't. My Shelby, she just celebrated this August 12th. She celebrated 9 years sobriety. Yeah. Yeah, pretty amazing. And she, The girls belong to, I'm just going to give a plug for YPAW. So my girls belong to YPAW. If you don't know what YPAW is, it's Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the YPAW kids. They're talented, they're energetic, they're enthusiastic, and we're in good hands. When I see these young people coming into AA and Al-Anon, I know, man, we're in good hands with these kids. And so at the end, they do all this crazy stuff, and I love it. It's irreverent. It's what I love. You know, I love that radical stuff. Of course I do. And they do this thing at the end, so I'll just say how I'll end this. I love you. Lots and lots and lots. A whole bunch. Thank you.
Wow, another round of applause for Guy and Debbie, please. It's awesome. This is our Al-Anon closing. In closing, I would like to say that the opinions expressed here were strictly those of the person who gave them. Take what you liked and leave the rest. The things you heard were spoken in confidence and should be treated as confidential. Keep them within the walls of this room and the confines of your mind. A few special words to those of us who haven't been with us long. Whatever your problems, there are those among us who have had them too. If you try to keep an open mind, you will find help. You will come to realize that there is no situation too difficult to be better and no unhappiness too great to be lessened. We aren't perfect. The welcome we give you may not show the warmth we have in our hearts for you. After a while, you'll discover that though you may not like all of us, you'll love us in a very special way, the same way we already love you. Talk to each other, reason things out, but let there be no gossip or criticism of one another. Instead, let the understanding and love and peace of the program grow in you one day at a time. Would all who care to join me in a moment of silence for all those who are still suffering, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Please come back for 7:30 for when everything gets kicked off.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I know you.
Thank you, my friend.
You're walking over to have pizza? Okay. I'll walk up with you.